Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Charity Charge Show. It has been a lot of fun recording episodes. And this week, I am with Charles Thomas, who is the Executive Director of Outward Bound Adventures. Charles, thank you so much for coming on. I'm excited to interview you.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Stephen, for inviting me.
Absolutely. You know, I've got a lot of questions for you. And, you know, what I just want to share with the audience is, you know, how much I appreciate you and we collectively all appreciate you and all the other wonderful nonprofit leaders. It's really what is so moving to me. And I just appreciate that you're out there doing the good work and you've been doing it for a very long time. Would you mind sharing with the audience just to start? We'll get into your background, which is important. I want to ask you some questions about that, but tell us what Outward Bound Adventures is and what your mission, maybe share a couple of examples about your organization, please.
Absolutely. So Outward Bound Adventures was created about 60 years ago, and it was it has a very interesting beginning. There is a little white woman that came out from Milledgeville, Illinois. And she came out to Northwest Pasadena. She was a teacher. And she landed at a school called Cleveland Elementary. It just so happened to be the same school that Jackie Robinson attended. He's the guy who broke the color barrier in Major League Baseball. And she was a science teacher, and she noticed that when she started taking her kids outdoors, that their grades improved. And so she started doing that a lot more. She created a junior Audubon club, and then she created a science club. And then out of that science club came Outward Bound Adventures. She got together with a bunch of parents of color. Back then, Pasadena was still very segregated. So the black and brown folks all lived in Northwest Pasadena, and the white folks lived in another part, East and West Pasadena. So, she got together with a group of concerned parents, a former Tuskegee Airman. His wife was a teacher and a counselor. And then the first African-American in the Sierra Club. And they formed the science club that ultimately became Outward Bound Adventures in 1962.
That's awesome. Can you talk to us a little bit about, you know, what it looks like in present day, some of the programming you have, what you're doing with the youth?
Yeah, one of the things that was the genesis that came out of the main program of Outward Bound Adventures, the main program was called Get Out and Learn, GOAL. And it was directed at bringing the underserved, the overlooked and avoided populations into the outdoors and connecting them to a bigger picture of themselves and a bigger picture of nature, which they traditionally didn't have even a small picture of, because most of the folks that we were serving back then were inner city folks. So a lot of folks from inner city East LA, inner city South LA, and just a major urban areas. And so the Get Out and Learn program eventually morphed into, when I took over, I was fortunate enough to be mentored by the three founding directors. But when I took over, we changed that into to several different programs. And those programs are our Teach Me to Camp program, which is for single low-income mothers to get out and camp with their family or their kids. We have another program called ERT, Environmental Restoration Teams, which is to teach folks how to do restoration work. Mostly urban kids of color, how to do restoration work so they can transition into a career in conservation. And then our big program is the Youth Advisory Council, the YAC, and they are the ones that inform all of our other programs. They keep us contemporary, and they say, well, that's not going to fly with young people, or this is going to work, but it's all done in an outdoor setting. They have their own set of curriculum. Then we have another program called, of course, DALI, which most people know about, and that's the Diverse Outdoor Leaders Institute, where every year we train about 25 urban people of color that come from the communities that that we serve, and then we turn around and then we hire them. They go through 15 weeks of training. we turn around and hire them, they become our staff. And then the last program we have is called the Environmental Studies Expeditions. And those are our longer courses. They go anywhere from 2 days to 26 days out in the wilderness. And they're all set to next generation science standards. And they're all learning about something around the outdoors and science.
That's awesome. It's awesome. You know, I felt, you know, when we were first chatting, you know, a few weeks back, we met, I felt really, in a way, connected to your organization, but also completely separated, right? I felt connected because I remembered being fortunate enough that my school would take us on different leadership and like skills-based learning through outdoor education. There was a place in Maryland where I grew up called Genesee Valley. And it was a ton of fun, and they had ropes courses and all those sorts of things. But then I also felt disconnected from it as well, because I was, had a lot of privilege in my life, you know, which I'm really grateful for. And access, you know, to financial resources, you know, that my parents, you know, were able to provide for me. So I'm curious, could you talk a little bit more to just expose it for people that are listening that maybe, aren't exposed to challenges, you know, that minorities and people that are less financially able are facing? Can you talk about some of the challenges that, you know, the youth are facing, and maybe just any sort of, I don't want to call it like highlights or examples that you've seen over the years of just how this has had such an impact on the youth?
Yeah, I'd love to. Thanks for asking that question, Stephen. It's a wonderful question. Most people don't have a clear understanding of some of the barriers that urban low-income people are facing, because there are self-imposed barriers that extend from, you know, for many different reasons. There might be, you know, like African-Americans not feeling safe to go into the woods. I remember talking to one of our founding directors, the Tuskegee Airmen, and I said to him, Mr. Chris, aren't you, when you go out there, aren't you afraid? Because they would go out for 14, 15 days in the woods. Aren't you afraid of getting eaten by a bear? And he just laughed at me and he said, I'm not afraid of getting eaten by a bear. I'm afraid of getting killed by those rednecks that are out there.
Right. So,
this was in the 60s and the 70s.
Wow.
I remember asking that. But so there's these self-imposed barriers out of safety that were derived from, you know, the ugly past that they've experienced. And then there's just barriers of the unknown, the lack of education, lack of exposure. And then there is, you know, some traditional barriers like unconscious bias that happens a lot. I remember bringing a group of kids up from Watts, as all African-American kids, and we were pulled up to a ranger's kiosk, and I'm asking him, you know, hey, what's a real difficult trail to travel on? So he looked past me and looked into the van. He saw all these little black kids and he said, oh, you don't want to go on that trail. You want to go on this trail. And I said, no, we want a really difficult trail. These kids have all been out before and blah, blah, blah. And so he said, no, you don't want to go. That trail's too difficult. And I was asking him for a specific trailhead. And then he started asking me, do you guys have water? Do you have a lunch? Do you know how to read a map? You know, and he was just approaching me as if I was a novice. And I, you know, I was really upset with him, but I, you know, real calm. And then, you know, a white family walked up to the kiosk, and there was two young girls and a mother and father. And they said, we're looking for a trail to go on. He said, oh, go on this trail. It was the very trail that I was asking to go on, you know. And so there's this. And I don't think that ranger woke up in the morning and said, okay, what am I going to do to keep people of color off the trail? I think his unconscious bias was acting. And then there are, so I can't tell you how many times where we've gone out and we've decided we're going to camp next to another group. And our group typically is all kids of color, and the people just pack up their stuff and leave, you know. They'll just, you know, some people will just say, oh, you know, we prefer our privacy, but other people just pack up their stuff and leave. In fact, we had one group of people that packed up their stuff and went and called the ranger and asked to be escorted out of the woods where they were because they felt like they weren't safe. So there are a lot of barriers like that. There's discrimination, of course. Mm-hmm. There's a lack of representation when you go into the National Park Service, which is really trying hard to change, or any other major land management agency, and you see no one who looks like you. You know, it's very easy to say, well, maybe I don't belong here. So there's that type of thing. And then there's marginality, where people just aren't able to get jobs in that particular area. There is also the fact that many trailheads are not anywhere near urban areas where people tend to cluster, right? Trailheads tend to be further out. And then there's no public transportation to the trailheads. So there's a lot of different barriers that we talk about, but there are probably two that I refer to as the barbed wire barriers, one of which is the inability for outdoor education. As you said, you were sort of privileged and you got to go out when you were younger. That doesn't happen. You know, these folks don't have outdoor ed school. They don't have summer camps. They don't have Uncle Ned to take some camping, you know, or mom and dad don't go on summer vacations to national parks. So they have no clue. I did a survey recently in classroom of pre-COVID classroom, and there were 30 something people. And then I asked the kids, they're mostly African-American, how many of you know where your nearest national park is? And none of them knew. Not a single kid knew where their nearest national park is. And that's not because they don't care. It's because they have not had the exposure or education about that kind of thing.
It's important that you point those out, and I appreciate it. I want to shift gears for a second, because a lot of, obviously, our audience, we work with a ton of nonprofit organizations and leaders. You've been the executive director for over 16 years, as I understand it.
That's correct.
I'm curious, you know, and feel free to reflect. You know, I try to keep these interviews as loose and light and organic as possible, so I didn't softball or send any of these questions in advance. But I'm curious to you, like, when you entered, you know, 16 years ago or so as the executive director to now, what do you think have been the biggest changes in how you lead the organization? And maybe sort of nothing's changed, or maybe, you know, but I would think naturally you've learned and grown over time. So how have you potentially evolved as an executive director and a leader, and or any of the learnings that you've kind of taken away from over the years?
I like that question, because I've been reflecting on that. I've actually done two stints at Outward Bound Adventures. I did 15 years, and then I went to work for the National Park Service as a regional ranger over the Pacific West region.
I got to just interrupt and just tell you that, you know, that's so cool. I think part of why I like you so much, I just feel like, even with Zoom, I feel like some sort of energy connection here. When I was graduating college, they had me take the Myers-Briggs, and the number one job that was, that I was a fit for was Park Service Ranger. All and right. I didn't go that path, but I always think about that when I'm contemplating what I'm doing, you know, with my work and my career. But go ahead. So you were at Outward Bound Adventures, and then you took a role as a park ranger.
Yeah, I took a role. I left for 5 years, and I went and created programs and ran the youth management portion. There's congressional funds that are allocated to go out to develop youth programs for the Pacific West region, which is 59 national parks. Anyway, I did that for 5 years, and I came back to Outward Bound. And when I came back, I was very different. I was very different because I had just worked in this paramilitary bureaucracy that's huge. The National Park Service is huge, you know. If you think about it, you know, an organization that has 27,000 employees, right? And, you know, and has parks all over the place, all over the world, actually. It was created in a time where a bureaucracy was needed, but it's no longer needed. And so you spend an inordinate amount of time doing a lot of tracking and trying to document on paper what you're doing, and you spend less time actually in the field actually doing what you're doing, unless you are a, I was at a bit of a higher range. I was in the management, top management section. So I oversaw 59 national parks and the youth programs that were in the national park. But anyway, when I came back, I brought sort of that mindset with me, OBA, and I realized that that wouldn't work in a smaller nonprofit. Nonprofits have to be a couple of things, but if not one, they have to be excessively nimble. You have to be able to stop and turn on a dime, because the people that you're serving sometimes will need one thing over another thing, and if you can't deliver that, then you're, you know, what you're trying mm-hmm. to do just makes you ineffective. Also, a nonprofit has to be extremely resourceful. You just don't have the steady cash flow that for-profits have. Most nonprofits don't. But where I've changed, I think most, Stephen, where I've changed most is actually looking at how we measure what we do. I think if you can't measure your impact, then you can't prove that you're doing something that you say you're doing. And for us, it's about how do we engage more urban people of color in the outdoor arena and get them moved towards careers in conservation. So we have to measure that. And OBA is well over 80,000 people now of serving them and getting them closer to the outdoors. And
it's amazing.
I'm working like crazy. We're developing an instrument with the Chicago School of Psychology right now to measure how much we're moving the needle. The other thing I'll tell you, and then we'll move on to the next question, is I think that I look at the caliber of the staff that we're hiring. Before it was, hey, you know, you want to work with kids and you know, you want to be outdoors, let me train you. But now we're very, very particular about the caliber of staff, because you're really working with some serious social, emotional issues that you have to pay close attention to as you move kids from the inner city to the deep wilderness, which we do often. Good question, though.
Well, great answer. You know, I think that especially what you talked about, being nimble, being resourceful, and, you know, being able to measure are, I've always was nimble and resourceful. I think that I've only over the past probably 12 to 18 months been measurable, so to speak, at Charity Charge in any material way. And I used to have an advisor who unfortunately passed away, an excellent person, Martin Slachter. And, but he used to always say to me, if you don't measure it, you can't manage it. Right. Yep. And so, I mean, I think it goes, obviously it rings true from a funding perspective and being able to show impact and all of that, but it gives you a barometer internally to then start adjusting. So I've become a huge fan, and we really probably over measure almost everything internally and kind of operationally at Charity Charge. But at any point in time, I can pull up our dashboard. We use Salesforce, and that has a lot of custom reports in it. And then we use Google Sheets, and we track everything. And it's really enlightening when you can see trends and other stuff pop out, or you could, it just starts to expose issues. So I highly, highly recommend that. I want to ask you sort of going back to your earlier years. I mean, as I, you know, was doing my homework on you, you know, one of the things that really stuck out to me was your passion and steadfast commitment to conservation and the environment. You know, and I know that a lot of that started when you were at Southern Oregon University. But I wanted to sort of get from you, why are you passionate about this? Was there something about your childhood or your own parents? I mean, what do you think? Because it sounds like, I mean, you were at least passionate about this as a college kid, right? Did it even predate that, and why?
Yeah, it did. It did predate that. And the answer I'm going to give you probably is going to be shocking to you, but my passion didn't begin so much out of, so I grew up in a housing project in Northeast LA. It was a very poor housing project and a lot of crime. But across the street from that housing project was a big big dirt lot. A lot that was undeveloped. And I would go over there and look for lizards and birds and just wonder about all the time in that lot. So that began my curiosity about nature. It wasn't really nature. It wasn't until we moved to Pasadena and I got involved with Outward Bound Adventures at a very early age in 1968. I got involved with Outward Bound Adventures that I started beginning to realize that we have an impact on the world. Remember, I was growing up during the late 60s and the 70s when major things were happening in the environment. That's when the Clean Water Act was created. That's when the National Environmental Policy Act was created. That's when the Endangered Species Act was created. All of this time were my formative years. And so I became an environmentalist. But the thing I was going to tell you was why I really wanted to be outdoors more is because as a teenager, I got in a lot of trouble, Stephen. I don't know if that pops up in my background, but I was incarcerated for well over 13 months, and I was in juvenile hall, and then I was in something called suitable placement, which is a place the courts put you. It's really an honor camp. But during the time I was in juvenile hall, and I remember this like it was yesterday, I was sitting in the room in this little 8x10 cinder block room locked behind the door. And I had already been on an OBA trip. I had already been to the Sierras. And something happened, somewhat of an epiphany was, I'm sitting in this room and I am thinking about the Sierras. And I said, you know what? I don't think I'll ever want to come back here. I don't want to lose my freedom. I remember the sense of freedom I had in the Sierras, backpacking through the Sierras. And that was one of the things that actually drove me. It was the fact that I lost my freedom and I was incarcerated, and I deserved to be incarcerated. Some of the stuff I was doing was not good stuff, but I lost my freedom. And then, just remembering back to when I had it and hiking through the Sierras really pushed me to go out. And from that point on, I spent a lot of time in the wilderness. There, after that, I developed this reverence and respect for the wilderness. So, you know, there were all these little things that were happening in my life in the 60s, especially in the late 70s. But the loss of freedom probably had the most profound impact on pushing me outdoors.
That's amazing. Thank you for sharing that. It's pretty unbelievable. I'm glad you turned out the way you turned out, you know? But I think that's also true. I mean, talk to me, I'm just sitting here. It's interesting to me, people's passions, how that then turns into service for others. So I just think it's interesting that you had this experience where you were in juvenile hall, you realized how valuable freedom was to you, and that how much appreciation and gratitude you had, you know, for the outdoors and that sense of freedom. And it was that pursuit, not in a negative way at all, but almost for yourself first, that allowed you then to give to others. And sort of like the connection that I'm trying to make is, we all talk about selflessness. We all talk about helping others. But the other sort of cliche thing that I learn is, the more that you're true to yourself and you are living, you're living your life for yourself, it then turns into service for others, which is a really beautiful thing that you just said. I'm curious if you have any comments on that.
Yeah, I do. You know, I want to keep my freedom, but I think one thing that really energized me from the very beginning, I was placed in a gang intervention program, and I was fortunate enough to recognize some of the, I had the cognitive wherewithal to figure out, okay, this is not for me, the stuff that I was doing. But there are a lot of people that just didn't have it. They had this victim mindset, or they didn't think that they could, they didn't have a growth mindset. And in the outdoors, you can really easily develop. You're much more malleable in the outdoors. So when I was going outdoors and doing this kind of stuff, I I can remember very clearly. I said, I want to dedicate my life to helping other people turn the light on by getting outdoors.
Mm.
And I think at that point, it was, you know, any pursuit that you get joy from could be considered almost selfish, right? But I decided that I needed to help young people who were like me that had gotten into trouble, who didn't understand the value and the therapeutic value and the life-changing and transforming impact the outdoors can have. I decided at that time, I must have been 18 or 19, that I was going to dedicate my life to making sure that people who couldn't get outdoors got outdoors. And that's one thing I can say. I've messed up on a whole lot of things, but that's one thing I've always been true to, is making sure that underserved people get connected to the outdoors.
That's awesome. That's so beautiful. I want, as we round out this interview, I want to focus on something exciting that I know you've been working on for a while, which is your book that will be released shortly. It is titled From the Hood to the Woods. And, you know, this book, as I understand it, highlights your 40 years of experience as it's written, designing outdoor education programs and facilitating urban youth into the wilderness. And for those that are interested in learning more, I'm sure that there's going to be a lot shared with that book. And I hope to get a copy. You let me know where I can pre-order it or even get a signed copy. But I think that's so awesome that you're going to be putting this together into a book. You must be excited for that.
I am. It's a long time coming. It's done. Mm-hmm. My daughter and my niece are helping edit it. My niece just got her PhD actually in communications. And so
awesome.
She's an awesome writer, as is my daughter. My daughter's an incredible writer. And so they're finding things in the book that I've already had it professionally edited. They're finding things in the book that even a professional editor didn't find. So we're going through that last rendition. We're adding the photographs, and then it goes to the publisher, or we're even thinking about self-publishing to move it along faster. But I've had two offers from publishers. But I am excited. It's been probably six, almost 7 years now that I've been working on it. In fact,
that's amazing.
It's crazy. It was too big at one time and I had to cut it down. They're telling me to make it into a series of books, but
wow. Wow. I can't wait to get a copy. So I think that's awesome. And I want to call out too, for those listening along, again, this episode of the Charity Church Show has been with Charles Thomas, who's the executive director of Outward Bound Adventures. If you're interested in getting involved, supporting their work, finding out more information, their URL is obainc.org, obainc.org, obainc.org. And I just think what you're doing is really tremendous, you know, obviously on the organizational level, and I'm inspired by and moved by your background and your whole story. So thank you for being inspiring to all of us, Charles.
You're quite welcome. And I appreciate the work that you're doing to support nonprofits. And I'll tell you that you're an excellent host. You know, disarming people and pulling out good information that other people need to hear. So you should really continue to do what you're doing in terms of your podcast. You're a very good host.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I do need to work on, I'm upgrading my setup a little bit and trying to figure out where is it. It's tucked behind here. I have a sort of a lamp, a light situation I got to get figured out, but it's good to have some raw talent, right? And then you can add on all the accessories and the fancy stuff, right? Thank you so much. We're going to wrap this one up again. Appreciate everyone that's been part of the Charity Charge community. New and old friends. Take care.